No.
Shabbos you
Okay, so why are you
can.
not allowed to have a non-Jew over for a Yontif meal, but Shabbos you're allowed to?
Because you might be
Yeah.
tempted to. Well, never mind. Go ahead. No.
Marina?
Because you allowed to cook on Yom Tov, but if you invite non-Jews, you kind of cooking for them because you keep them in mind, so it is prohibited. And then a
Exactly.
Shabbos,
Oh.
we don't cook at all, so it is not an issue.
I was thinking just the opposite, that for Shabbos, you might be tempted to say, can you please open the light for me or do something for me that you're not allowed to do?
Amir Lahakim is an issue on Yom Tov also.
Yes.
Yeah. Toby, you're saying something, but you're muted.
I had learned in the past, or I thought I did, that you can't have a non-Jew for the first Seder, but you can for the second.
Oh, but you're saying,
Yep.
okay, maybe I'm forgetting that. But I would imagine it would be a similar concern that again,
Yes.
you're
Maybe
cooking for
because the second Seder is only,
Rabbanan.
in diaspora.
I think that concern still applies, but you know what? I wouldn't be surprised. I haven't looked deeply into it because I don't have a lot of
No, in fact,
non-Jews lining up.
I know this issue has come up at the
Yeah.
shul.
Ah, okay.
When
So
there
you
was
know,
like the communal Seder, and they would
you know.
generally do it the second night,
Yeah.
so
I mean,
there
I
wouldn't
wouldn't be
be an issue
surprised if
if somebody
someone's.
had,
Yeah.
questionable credentials or whatever, then you didn't have to get into it.
That's a good question. You know what? Maybe we'll do that as a pre-Seder class. So let me look more into that. I could concoct a svar also that it's derabanan. So what, we're gonna have a chashash on a derabanan that you might cook more for the non-Jew. Okay, you know what? There's what to discuss. Okay, good ideas. I already have a
But
few
wait a
classes.
second. If you have a Seder, can you invite a non-Jew if you're not doing the cooking?
It's a gezeira in general. It's a low plug. The idea is, Rabbi said, we're concerned that you will cook extra for that non-Jew coming. So there's no inherent issue with having a non-Jew join you for a meal. It's that since we allow cooking on Yom Tov, and what's the purpose of the allowance of cooking on Yom Tov? So
Make
that
it
we
nice
can
for
have
us.
Simchas Yom Tov. Now, who is obligated to celebrate Yom Tov? Jewish people. So then you're not allowed to cook. That allowance is not there to cook for people who don't have an obligation to celebrate
No,
Yom Tov.
but my point is, A, what if you're not doing the cooking? Or B, it's the first Seder and you haven't, the cooking's all done.
I don't believe it makes a difference because I think it's just a general gezeira with a low plug. There's no distinction, no discrepancy. But that's an interesting point. You know what? Let me look through the sources. Maybe we'll make this a Monday night class before Pesach, all right?
Are
But
you
anyway,
talking just about today?
we have a completely different topic for tonight. So let's just get to that because we're 10 minutes in.
Yeah.
But this is a good discussion. If you look in the chat, this has nothing to do with Pesach, what we're talking about. I figured I'd get in a few more Sternbach stuff before I'm contractually obligated to start talking about Pesach. No, I'm just kidding. It's already Shloshim Yom Kol Chag. We do need to talk about it. If you look at the sheet inside the chat, there's a tshuva from Rav Moshe Sternbach in general. You are welcome to follow along with the sheet if that's something that's accessible. And if not, you're welcome to just listen to my voice and look at everyone's wonderful faces on the screen.
I
It's
don't
not
see
in my
anything.
chat.
Oh,
Yes,
so you
I'm
know
on
what?
YouTube.
Because whenever I
Yes.
upload it, if someone is not present at the time of upload, I don't think it lets you look back at the chat. So let me re-upload
Okay,
it.
don't worry. I'll just listen. It's fine.
I just
No worries.
uploaded it, so it'll be there in a second. Okay, great.
Thank you.
So let's start. So, very disturbing topic, but very fascinating from a policy and public policy halakhic standpoint. Child molestation in schools.
Ew.
That was the appropriate reaction, Toby.
Right.
Exactly.
Yep.
So now, why? Now, obviously, the shaila isn't mutter to, God forbid, molest a child. That's not the question. Thank God, even in any community, that's not even a havamina. The question is rather, and this isn't limited to child molesting. This is really a question of mesira. There is a terrible category called a moser or a miser. A moser is somebody who gives over another Jew to the non-Jewish authorities. If they found out that a Jew, and this question comes up with taxes all the time, Ramosha Feinstein has a tshuva. If somebody's working for the IRS and they do an audit on a fellow Jew, can they, you know, can they rout out a Jew for cheating on his taxes and thereby having him incarcerated because of that? And then, you know, child molestation or child abuse is another place that unfortunately comes up. And it really comes up in any and many areas of life where there's this category of a moser. And it's not just like a little aveira. I mean, obviously, it's not up to me to start measuring how bad different sins are. But a moser, just if you look in like the Rambam, you look in different halachic codes, you're allowed to kill a moser. How many times in halacha do you see that you can extrajudicial? You can, this is not even by Beis Din, because a moser is someone who has a status of a rodef. Remember the classic case in Sanhedrin? Anyone who went to modern Orthodox high school, I guarantee you probably studied this case in Sanhedrin. They all love doing it. So the case of rodef. Reuven's chasing after Shimon. Reuven's attempting to kill Shimon. And then you are allowed to, if you can't incapacitate him, if your only option is to kill Reuven to save Shimon, you could kill Reuven because he's a rodef acher Shimon. He's pursuing Shimon to kill him. And so a moser, somebody who's reporting on fellow Jews to the authorities and having them incarcerated or executed, that's usually what happened back in the day. They'd be executed for cheating on anything. Then that person is can be killed. That person can be killed because he's a threat to the Jewish community. And I'm not remembering offhand correctly, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's a statement to some extent of Ein lo chelek olam haba, he has no portion of the world to come. All the terrible forms of imprecations are basically applied to this kind of person. And so the question that comes up to Rav Moshe Sternbach is it mutter to report someone to the authorities, or is this something that should be handled within the Jewish community? So now this may be, again, a little bit of a foreign question to those of us who, which I assume are almost all of us on here, grew up or currently find ourselves within the modern Orthodox community, where Baruch Hashem, we have a strong connection and a lot of trust built between us and our Stanford Police Department. I know Rabbi Cohen told me recently, and I think he's shared this with the shul, that there's a new program in Stanford where the police are doing outreach and they invited different clergy. He's participating in it. They invite different clergy to build bridges between the communities and the police. But I think one of the things sociologically we need to pick up on is that especially in the more Haredi community, they haven't forgotten that back in Europe and back in Russia, the police weren't the good guys. The police were usually the ones who were committing anti-Semitic acts against the Jews. I mean, we all watch Fiddler on the Roof, right? You know that scene at the wedding where they all come in and they destroy the whole place? That was the police back then. So, you know, you hear these stories. I remember being told about a woman who survived the Holocaust. She came to America and she encountered police there and her heart skipped a beat. She got all frightened. And then her child had to explain, no, the police over here are here to protect us. They're not here to antagonize us. But I think that part of Jewish history is still alive in the memory, especially, you know, in Jewish memory in general, but also I think somewhat, especially in the Haredi community. And I guess arguably in the very liberal community today also, but for very different reasons.
Right.
So there's a question of seeing, you know, the Goyim, you'll forgive me for that, for if that sounds like a slur, but that's how they be referred to, the other as antagonizing the Jewish people, and giving over a Jewish person to the police is seen as a much different act in that community than it's perceived for us, who we perceive the police generally as being on our side. So that's one thing, just a sociological thing to think about. It's not the case for all Haredi communities, by the way. Many Haredi communities have very strong ties with their police departments. It varies, but again, I think that's something that's stressed, that there's still this mentality of it's the Jews and then it's the Goyim, and you know, that we're not the same people, that there's that idea. Anyway, that's all by way of introduction. Now, the policy, I'm pretty certain, in the modern Orthodox community is if someone is molesting a child, God forbid, we report that to the police. That's not even, I don't think, it's something you even need to consult a rabbi on. That's something that you just report right away, unless someone thinks otherwise. But again, don't think just about child molestation here. Think about, what if I know my neighbor is cheating on his taxes? What if I know my neighbor is, you know, committing something a little bit less heinous than abusing or molesting a child? But so something like, something of that nature, right? I know someone is cheating on their taxes. Am I allowed to report that? Should I report that? Am I being a jerk for reporting that? Am I a moser if I report something like that? So if that helps you conceptualize the topic, you could just repeat, you replace something like child molestation with this, and let's see where it goes. Okay. So
they're reading really not the same, though. They're really not the same.
Because one's harming someone, one is not.
Right.
Physically.
Okay, can someone, absolutely, that's a good distinction. Can someone give me a good example of something that...
One's personal. One's personal doesn't affect anybody else. It's only the person who cheats. On himself.
Well, no.
You could say it hurts.
No, the person who, I mean, he's technically cheating on everybody in the United States who,
well, yeah,
you know,
but
isn't getting the benefit of his tax dollar. But yeah, still, it's certainly not the same as, you would say it's a victimless crime.
Yeah, right.
We can get further, like cheating on exam or something.
Right. Yep. So there is a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein, a few about cheating. And there's actually one that we might do when we move on from Moshe Sherbach. Eventually, we'll get to Rav Moshe Feinstein. He has a tshuva about a classroom. And is a Rebbe, is a teacher, allowed to basically impose collective punishment on the kids? One kid, I don't know, I'm forgetting myself. Yeah, what's like a pedestrian example of something a kid would do? One kid shout out while the teacher is writing on the board, talked during class and made some sort of slur, whatever it was, and the teacher wants to punish that kid. So the teacher says, until somebody tells me who said that thing during class, I'm going to keep all of you in during recess. I remember that happening to me as a kid. I was like going to say, you know what, I'll just like take the bullet, bite the bullet, right? But Rav Moshe Feinstein said that a teacher is not supposed to impress upon a student to tattle on the other student. So there is that kind of example that comes up in the classroom as well. But your point's well taken. There's something like a victimless crime, arguably, like cheating on taxes. And there's something heinous like molesting. Can someone give us just like a good example that's not as emotionally repugnant to think about as molesting a child, but isn't considered victimless either, something that someone might report on? Just give us a good example to work with here. Anyone think of something?
If you see somebody stealing from somebody, like pickpocketing.
Okay. All right. Sure. Let's go with something like that. So if that helps you, just replace those in your mind. Okay, here we go. Nishalti otos adam ra ma'alim sheyaldu sipuru shal eitan tchufos rotzalasima masim gunim. So he started, Rav Moshe Sherbach heard that there were reports about a particular Rebbe at a school who was doing inappropriate things with the children. And the parents in the school want to report the teacher to the police department and have him locked up in jail. Now the challenge is, even though we don't have, now, those who are in our Makos class on Thursday nights, what's the golden proof that you need in Basin? What's a typical proof?
Two witnesses.
Ah, so someone might be tempted to say, well, just like you need any crime in Basin needs two witnesses, you might need two witnesses over here. The thing is, even Moshe Sherbach, who is, of course, a very staunch traditionalist, he is willing to say, this is a kind of crime that you don't see. This is a kind of crime that's done behind closed doors that's impossible to clarify with witnesses. Already, this is very radical for someone of Moshe Sherbach's halachic methodology. We can suffice with an umdana demuchach. What is an umdana demuchach? a little unclear exactly what the parameters are, but an umdana generally is a principle that we don't have like a statistic or a proof, but we know human nature works a certain way. That's what an umdana is. Rabbis in the Gemara do that all the time. So we have an umdana demuchach. Like if we have so many people are coming to the same conclusion because they keep seeing different suspicious acts being done, but they didn't literally see this heinous act being committed, that's enough of a reason for us to have to report somebody like this. Mihu, Rav Echad Zok, the Kim Shar Kosi Anisho, so Gabi Chukia Akum, Sha'onshu Adar Zeb Masa Lakama Shanim. However, some people, it could be the principal or it could be the actual teacher himself, their counterclaim is that in the secular judicial system, you could get locked up for 12 years, for many years in their system. Lefi Dine Yisrael, Eino Chai Bonesh Gazet. There's no such thing as being locked up for 12, 20 years, a lifetime in prison, Jewish law. Al Kain, Osir Lemosir, Lemishtarva, Osakein, Dino Kamoser. So what they're saying is, if you turn me over to the secular authorities, according to the Torah, I'm not deserving of such a punishment of being incarcerated in prison for all these many years. So if you give me over to the police, then you actually, now you get the status of a Moser and you are a Rodef. And so the argument that's made by some is that this is a matter that shouldn't be handled, shouldn't be given over to the secular non-Jewish authorities, but should be handled internally within the Jewish community, if that's possible. And this is almost, it's not a good analogy, but this reminds me a little bit of the debate about sexual assault on campus. So what will happen many times, I'm not so familiar, but I only know from reading articles about it, which I guess is what we all do, either in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, whatever you're reading, you'll get different perspectives on this issue in both papers. So if there's an accusation of sexual assault on a college campus, many times it won't actually go to the judicial system. It won't go through the state government or whatever it's supposed to go through, the municipality. But instead, there will be like these college courts that they set up to determine if somebody committed sexual assault. And they'll make their own decisions. So I remember there was like a whole debate, you know, whether that's problematic, because then maybe these aren't real judges. They have their own biases. And so might not get a fair trial based on these college tribunals. Does anyone know what I'm referring to? Is this like a new concept? Have we read about this in the news?
The Wall Street Journal has covered it extensively.
Okay.
It goes on in college campuses, has been akin to a star chamber proceeding, kangaroo court. The Trump administration tried to correct it. It started under the Obama administration with a letter from the education secretary to their colleagues, being the college administrators. Somewhere during the Trump administration, there was another dear colleagues discouraging that sort of thing. And I expect it's going to go back to the pre-Trump situation where the kangaroo courts, if you're a mail-in, you're accused, you're guilty.
Okay, so right. So that definitely, Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have an actual case. A family happened to a cousin of mine. His daughter went to a school in New York, and she was a very lovely, innocent child. And she met a boy there, and he invited her to his room, and he tried to rape her. And she said no, she was not interested, but he raped her. And the school handled it as the example you gave, and he was asked, he was made to leave the school, but they didn't bring it to a, he wasn't brought to a civil court.
Right. So that's a very unfortunate case. And it could really, I think as you're saying, as my grandfather is pointing out, it could really go both ways. And one of the challenges of handling something internally is, on the one hand, if something's handled internally, there's less losing face there might be less humiliation on part of the litigants and the people involved. And you can imagine this is very important for people in the Jewish community, that last thing people want is to see another rabbi on the front of the New York Post being accused for committing a terrible crime. But on the other hand, the disadvantage to trying to regulate all these serious cases internally is that either, you know, the man who is the rape, I mean, this can still happen in the judicial system also, you know, it's not perfect there, but definitely if you handle things internally, you might have the same resources to get to the bottom of the matter and figure out who really is the culprit, what's actually happening. And that's one of the challenges here as well, which is his inclination to sometimes handle these matters internally. I mean, why you, for instance, after the Child Victims Act that was opened up by New York State. So, you know, why you, for instance, had to revisit a lot of things that came up, because I believe during Rabbi Lam's tenure, there was an issue with MTA and there was a whole cover up about it. And so it really presents these challenges. Like, on the one hand, you don't want to create more of a scene and have more, what's the right word for it?
Publicity.
You don't want more publicity happening because of this. But on the other hand, you might not actually address the heart of the issue as well. So, okay, let's move forward. So the next paragraph, V'nir d'lo rak shemutter. So what's the answer? What do you think he's going to answer? He says, V'nir d'lo rak shemutter, ela adaraba, he got mitzvah gedola lasos, not only, remember when we talked about if a school is allowed to deny a family that won't vaccinate their children for measles to come to school? Sir Moshe Sherman made a whole argument, but he concluded it's mutter, it's permissible for the schools to deny entry to unvaccinated children when the rest of the kids are vaccinated. He didn't say that they have to. He didn't say that they're chay, that they're obligated. But here he's saying not only is it permissible to turn someone over to the authorities in this case, but it is a mitzvah to turn someone over to the authorities in such a case. But the challenge is that you have to do just enough. What's the goal over here? And he's going to say this actually, if you look on Tuf Mem Av, the next page on the bottom, he's going to say, what's the goal of turning someone over to the authorities? Now, there's really two goals generally people have when they report a child molester or any person who's a criminal to the authorities. Number one, to stop him from perpetrating any future atrocities. And number two, for punitive purposes. You want recompense. You want revenge on this person. It's very natural to want to exact justice and revenge on a person who committed such terrible acts toward you or a loved one of yourself. But what Moshe Sternbach says is, this is an important line, you can do anything you need to do to stop him from perpetrating future acts, but you can't turn someone over to the authorities if you know, if somehow it's possible that you know this person, I mean, I don't know, they were castrated, whatever was done to them, you know that they're not going to commit any future acts, then it would not be permissible to turn them over to the secular authorities just to get your revenge on them. But if you know that they are going to do future acts, then you're allowed to turn them over to the authorities. He writes, Avim Nira, so just skipping to the underline at the bottom of the paragraph. Avim Nira La Rash Kol Oshali Asima Osub Masar Yamshik Masam Agunim Shekedusha Bismanenu Misha Hiskum Masam Elu Kushalo Biosir Lifoshmehem. Someone who's committed these kind of acts before, he's abused, he's molested these children, he has a chazaka, there's a presumption that he's not going to stop at one, but he's going to continue doing that. The chazaka sheyamshich lasos came. The elo takana ela tovso bebeis hasor. Many times there's no solution but to incarcerate such an individual. Azai mitzvah gedola sheyelchu lahay negdo barkos deshiani shuhu b'masar. Therefore, there is again a mitzvah to turn him over to the authorities and to make sure he's incarcerated to keep him from committing this crime again. And by the way, I just want to point out, he doesn't actually, I don't think he even references the Gemara in Sanhedrin here, but this isn't as novel of a position as one might think. So, you know, whenever we had Parshas Mishpatim recently. So in Parshas Mishpatim, we learned, of course, about the famous Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri is this Jewish person. He steals from somebody and he doesn't have enough money to pay back. So what does Beis Din do? The court sells him. And with that money, they compensate the person. But, you know, like every rabbi likes to get up there on Shabbos and they say, ah, you see, the beauty of the Jewish judicial system is that nobody will ever be put in jail. We don't believe in jail. We believe in rehabilitation. We believe in taking this criminal and putting it in somebody's home so he could recuperate there, which is a whole other discussion, by the way. I don't know how many people want thieves in their homes so that they'll steal from them again. But anyway, but actually there is a notion. It might not be strictly mandated by halacha, but it's something called a kippah. Now, a kippah is what I'm wearing on my head, but a kippah also refers to a prison cell of sorts. In Sanhedrin, it talks about if somebody keeps, someone's a danger to society. And what we're going to learn in our Gemara class on Thursday night is that in a few weeks, actually, it's very hard to put somebody to death in Jewish court. You can get off on so many technicalities. Maybe the witnesses didn't warn you within the right amount of time. Maybe one of the witnesses was invalidated and he invalidated all the other witnesses in his cot along with him. So if someone gets off on a technicality, but Beis Din is confident that this person, so he gets off on a technicality. He really should have gotten capital punishment, but he got off on his technicality. What do? So we're afraid that he's going to go murder more people. They could put him in his kippah. They could put him in this jail cell of sorts, and they basically keep him there. They feed him not the most nutritious food, and they keep him there until he dies in that cell, because since we can't trust him in society, we're not allowed to give him capital punishment, so we have to incarcerate him to keep him from murdering more people. So there actually is this notion already as early as the Talmud in Sanhedrin. So even though Moshe Shurach doesn't reference it here, I have to believe that this is the spirit of what he is suggesting as well. Let me just pause for a moment. Any questions on any of the premises or points that we made until here? Okay, clear so far. Great. He quotes if you look on Tufim Aleph on the next page, he quotes the Ramah as precedent. The Ramah in Choshe Mishpat writes, Yesh omrim da adam hamuka mechavero. If someone is being antagonized, literally hit, but he's being antagonized by a fellow Jew, yachol leilech likbo bifnei goyim, afal pidegoring lamaka hazeh hezek gadol. He's allowed to seek recourse in a civil court, even though the punishment that the civil court will give him is disproportionately more severe than what he would have gotten in a Jewish court. And I think this might be a little relevant to what Rabbi Weissman, our scholar in residence, discussed about the base of America, that generally we encourage two Jews to go to the Beis Din, but if I'm in a dispute with another Jew and he refuses to go to Beis Din, to a Jewish court, then okay, look, if I could only seek recourse at a civil court, then that's what I have to do. It's not seen as an affront to God or to the Jewish judicial system if he's not willing to show up for the subpoena that he gets from it. Also, he writes on the next underline, Kol shekeisha benito vidun, shenze rak hakoba alma. Certainly this Ramah applies in our case, which isn't simply a case where someone is harassing somebody else, someone is antagonizing him somewhat. Elohu mitame yolodu apogim v'nashol netzach. When this man commits this disgusting act of abusing and molesting these children, it's not just like a one-time antagonization, but he traumatizes these children for the rest of their entire lives. This isn't just like a simple act of one person antagonizing another. The repercussions and consequences of such a crime committed is something that's so terrible and so severe that it needs to be addressed as soon as possible. Next underline in the second last paragraph in the first column of Tufim Aleph. Hein emes shebeshehia b'maser kama shanim ol shiskalkul sham yoser. Now, granted, I agree. I concede that if we put him in court in the jail system, he will, like, let's be honest. You know, when I went to Rikers for Pesach a number of years ago, not because I was incarcerated, but went there as a chaplain to help out at the Seder. Oh, that's another story. Maybe I should talk about that over Pesach. But when I went to Rikers with another rabbinical student at the time, I mean, you just look around and it's, you know, you hear these inspirational stories, but it's very hard to believe that people are really being recuperated and they come out better people than they went in. It's very hard to believe that. Not to say I spent extensive time there, thank God, but just from the little I see, it's hard to believe that. And mm-hmm. Ramosha Sherman says, that's true. I don't think you're going to come out of jail a better person. But Mikol Makom, it's not about him only. It's not just about this teacher, about this molester. Because it's true that he might not come out a better person. It might be detrimental for his own welfare to be in prison. But frankly, that's not our problem. Our first and primary concern is to make sure that he cannot harm more people. And therefore, whatever we need to do, even means seeking recourse with the secular authorities, we have to put him behind the bars in order so he doesn't harm more people. However, the important exception or caveat that he gives, the important qualification he gives on the bottom of the page, but remember, if this person, if we can find out, again, I'm not sure exactly how, you know, maybe he went to a psychologist, maybe he was chemically or physically castrated, that he won't want to do these terrible things anymore, then the only reason to turn him over to the authorities at that point is for punitive purposes. He says you cannot turn someone over to the secular authorities just to be punished on something limafreya, something that was done in the past. It could only be done as a precaution to protect us in the future. Therefore, anyone who gives over somebody to the authorities merely and exclusively to be punished by them, Vosakin over be iser mesira hachamor ma'od, the ein lo chilek le'olam haba. There's a line over there. I was right. So someone who commits this act of mesira, of giving this person over to the secular non-Jewish authorities, if it's only to punish him but not to protect society, he then becomes a moser, and he has no portion in the world to come. Wow, that's an extreme statement there. Not surprised by that. We're all on the same page as Ramosha Schermach. Okay, wow. He must be making a very compelling argument tonight. Usually we have our disagreements with him. But as long as there's something in the future that might happen, okay. And then he adds on one additional consideration for why this is something so severe. If you look on the top of Taf Mem Aleph, he says, Uma od, shekesha adam osek, litmos yolade Yisrael, harehu karodev achar zachar. Now, here's the analogy to Rodev. You see, when this teacher, right, he works at a cheder, and he's molesting the little children that are with him, these little boys, he has the status of being a rodef achar zachar. He has a status of pursuing someone to commit homosexual relations with them. And the halacha in the Gemara and Sanhedrin is she'im i'afshir lamono ela aydei shenahargu mitzvah lahargo. The same way, if someone, Reuben's pursuing Shimon to murder Shimon, if I cannot incapacitate Reuben, if my only recourse is to kill Reuven to save Shimon's life, I save Shimon's life by killing Reuven. So too over here, if Reuven is chasing after Shimon to sodomize him, then Reuven, if the only way to stop Reuven is to kill him, then I can even go so far as to kill him. So here, Dino, next underline, Dino Kedin Rodig, Afba Osa Shoshin Ose Vikach. And you know what? Now you might say, if the proof is from the case of Rodig, maybe it needs to be like Ruvain is literally pursuing Shimon to commit this terrible act with him. But here, Ramosha Shemart says, no. Even if, you know, the SWAT team breaks in and they arrest him, and he's not, he's in the middle of just like eating dinner and, watching movies on YouTube during dinner. And then you break in and the SWAT team breaks in and they're like, he's not in the middle of committing, raping or molesting anyone. So we can't put him behind bars. It doesn't matter. He is constantly considered to be in a state of rodef. Even when he's not committing this act, he is always primed to be committing such a terrible act. And I need to clarify, by the way, this doesn't mean someone, this is not referring to someone who has the urge of pedophilia. There's no halakha against someone who has that urge of pedophilia. But if someone has already molested a child, and we see this is something that they do, we assume that at all moments they could potentially be committing that act, and therefore they have the status of a rodef, and someone could report them at that moment. And it's rooted in the Gemara and Sanhedrin that way, that someone who's a rodef achar zachar could be put in jail. Now, the interesting part over here, by the way, he makes an analogy to rodef achar zachar, but I think the same issue would apply if it wasn't a boy, but if it was a girl. But I think he's just piling an additional sin that's being committed, an additional consideration. Okay, that's the end of this section.
Lost you.
What was that? Oh, is everyone still there?
Your voice was wavy. Yeah.
Okay. It's back. We're back.
Yes, back.
Yes.
It's back
okay.
Now.
Okay. Great to be back with all of you. Okay. So, here's the thing. Here's something unique. Now, at this point, what would you say, right? If you find out. Again?
No.
Again, the internet's not good?
Yeah, you wait for a minute. Now, okay.
Now you're okay? Okay, great. Now, yeah, the issue is, I think it's because Marissa's in the other room watching Full House right now. So I think that uses some of our Wi-Fi broadband.
Don't blame it on Marissa.
I'm blaming it on her. I'm blaming it on Full House.
If you blame things on Marissa, I'm going to rat to her parents.
Right. I was blaming it on the particular TV show, but you can take it that way if you like. Anyway.
I'll go to your in-laws.
What was that, Zadie?
I'll go to your in-laws.
All right.
I don't know where to find them.
Right. So I would think at this point that, okay, great. So, I mean, not great, but I understand the halakha. I see someone's committing this act. I have good reason to assume that they're committing it, even if I haven't seen it myself. I can report this person to the authorities. But Ramosha Shermach says, you know, what's going to stop somebody? You know, what we see a lot happening today, less so with child molestation, I mean, maybe there as well, but a big challenge that's come up in America, I don't want to get too political, but again, I reference current events just so this is a contemporary issues class after all. So when you think about accusations of rape that happened today in America, there's this whole debate about how much weight do you give to the accuser versus how much weight do you give to the presumption of innocence? And I'm sure we all remember the Brett Kavanaugh hearings mm-hmm. that happened. And that was really a flashpoint for this debate in the United States, which is when someone makes an accusation of impropriety is a light term in that case, of rape or molestation. So, you know, how much is the onus upon the accuser and how much is it upon the person who's accused to exonerate himself? Because on the one hand, the challenge that's presented is on the one hand, there's a presumption of innocence. If so, you know, otherwise, if we don't presume innocence, anyone can accuse anyone and then they have to prove themselves innocent. But on the other hand, the issue when it comes to issues like molestation and rape, as Ramosha Schermach pointed out, is that many things don't take place before two witnesses. They generally happen in the privacy of a bedroom, behind closed doors. So it's something that you can never fully prove in most cases. And so the challenge it creates, that Ramosha Schermach at least is dealing with, is he is concerned that people might have half-baked concerns, and before they investigate the matter enough, their first instinct is to run straight to the authorities, make an accusation against this person. He's going to be on the front page of the New York Post. And a few weeks later, they realize that they could have put a few more details together, and they realize that they were making a mistake and there was really no issues altogether. So Ramosha Schermach recommends, and this is a little bit Haredi in how he says it, Miu dash ain't another hefker. This isn't a hefker matter. You can't just run around making accusations against Jews because you have the slightest slightest suspicion that they're committing impropriety. I can't just make accusations willy nilly based on a rumor that I concocted. But rather, he says, you have to go to a rabbi first, and you have to get a psak from that rabbi saying, or heter rather, saying that you are permitted to go to the police in that kind of case. Now, I think he says, I don't think it's that you need a real heter, by the way. It's not that you need a real heter. It's almost like using birth control. Remember we gave a class about, how many children does one have to have? When does, birth control and all that stuff. So people will consult a rabbi about when they can stop having kids and when they can take birth control. So the moderate approach to it is that there's no isser to take birth control per se. But what people sometimes go to a rabbi for is that they want a third party person who's not particularly biased one way or the other to bounce ideas off of him. So, maybe that rabbi is able to help them figure out, okay, I hear that you're at this place financially. I hear that you're going to be moving into a bigger apartment later. He's going to help you bounce off ideas for consideration. So the idea of the rabbi over here is, I think, serving more of a communal leadership position than he's actually serving a strict halachic hat. He's wearing his pastoral communal leadership hat. He's not wearing his posek hat on right now. And so he's not really giving a heter, but the idea is going over to someone who hopefully has some seichel, has some common sense, and is a reasonably well thought out person, can help you think about it before you jump straight to the authorities. That's, I think, what he's suggesting. Shim Lokin, because if you don't do so, Nasata Torah's kol echa biyado, you put the fate of every person in your hand. And everyone can just figure out on their own. Because here's the challenge. You see, even if someone accuses somebody of committing impropriety, then the issue is, even if that person is ultimately, the person accused is ultimately proven innocent in the end of the day, their reputation is still going to be tarnished beyond repair. Even if they come out fully innocent, 100% exonerated, just by the fact that someone was, trigger happy and made an accusation could automatically destroy someone's career and reputation. That's on one hand. The issue is, on the other hand, the longer you take and the more doubts you have before going to the authorities gives this person who's potentially committing these crimes more opportunity to commit them at the same time. So it really puts people in a very difficult position. And that's why he recommends talking to a third party about it. However, on the next page, Tufman Basie writes, if you're confident and you've consulted another colleague, you've talked to another person, and you know this person's committing these terrible acts, then who knows the potion of mitzvah. If you don't report this person, then you're violating the mitzvah of, one of my favorite mitzvahs, right? Anyone know what that means? And you shall eradicate the evil from your midst. Now, why is that my favorite? It's not that it's my favorite mitzvah. It's that whenever I get to this mitzvah, I always get a kick out of it. Because you know how many people, they cherry pick psukim from the Torah that fit their agenda? So people will cherry pick things like V'ahavtem esager, you shall love the stranger. Therefore, God clearly wants us to have open borders, you know, and that's their proof from the Torah. The funny thing is, someone could also just say, "Uvi'artar mi'ah mikirbecha," you should eradicate all these people from your midst. You know, that you can say the very same thing to deport people. So it's not that it's my favorite mitzvah. It's that you can easily find psukim that are mentioned many times in the Torah that give you an opposite kind of sense, and you just cherry pick them out of the blue. Anyway, so at the end over here, the last part of the tshuva, we're not going to read inside. Ramosha Sternbach basically copies a letter that he literally, like basically almost verbatim, a letter that he sent to a school that was running through this challenge. And he said over there that if the person seeks psychological care and they can somehow guarantee he's not going to commit and perpetrate these acts again, then you don't report him. But it's very hard to get convinced by that. And if you're not convinced by that, then you certainly would need to report such a person. I want to clarify, all this is Rav Moshe Sternbach's position. There is some more debate. I think there are those who are even more hesitant than him to report people to the police, even in these cases. They think almost every case needs to be run internally. And there are those who are more liberal on this issue. Can you believe it? More liberal than Rav Moshe Sternbach. And they would jump much faster to report someone to the police than Rav Moshe Sternbach would. But anyway, this is a very fascinating tshuva and a very notable tshuva from Rav Moshe Sternbach. And I think it opens up the whole question about how do we balance protecting potential victims in a community versus also not harming people who might not necessarily be committing the acts we think that they're committing. It's a very hard question to answer, and there's no one answer to such a question, but I think at least the advice of seeking or bouncing ideas off another person before going out and making an accusation or seeking support from somebody else is always something that we would encourage. But of course, I'm not speaking policy over here. This is a shir, halach of lola maisa. But you know, if God forbid, if anyone is involved in any such cases, on a very serious note, you know, Rabbi Cohn and I are here for you to reach out to. But that's all I have to say on that. Okay.
You better go talk to Cuomo.
Talk to Cuomo.
You want them, we'll give them to you.
Right.
All right. Any questions? Okay, great.
Thank you.
So next week we have a scholar in residence, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Unger. He's a fantastic academic scholar. He's going to talk about Jewish conceptions of governance and economic policy. He's a huge Talmud Chacham in the traditional sense of really knowing his stuff in terms of rabbinic literature. He's a well-accomplished academic at Wagner College. So I invite you to come on literally during this slot next week, Monday night. And then after that, we'll do some Pesach Torah, Pesach Halachos to prepare for the holiday.
That's good. That's good.
All right.
Yes.
Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.